I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
An Ohio truck driver named Ayman Faris has admitted meeting with Osama bin Laden and other top al-Qaeda figures. And federal officials say he got chillingly close to trying to bring down the Brooklyn Bridge, only backing off just a few months ago when he told an unnamed friend in a coded message, "The weather is too hot." Heat, presumably, last winter, from Attorney General John Ashcroft's Justice Department, which announced the arrest of Faris yesterday, having kept him in secret custody for 3 months. Eric Lischblau covers the Justice Department for the New York Times. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot for joining us. Eric, what do we know about this guy?
Well, this is someone who was who had regular contact with people at the highest ranks of al-Qaeda. He appears to have been in regular contact through early this year with one of bin Laden's top lieutenants, a man by the name of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was captured in March and was engaged in various plots, the most sensational being the attempt that you mentioned to bring down the Brooklyn Bridge.
He was on the surface a very ordinary guy.
Yeah, he was a truck driver in Ohio. Ashcroft described him as someone who led a double life, who would sort of freely crisscross the country on his truck routes, but was also in Pakistan and Afghanistan for several years, beginning in about 2000, and was involved in logistical operations and support for al-Qaeda.
Do we know the key piece of evidence that led to his arrest?
The authorities aren't saying a whole lot about how they built their case against him, but it would appear that they had probably electronic eavesdropping evidence and or human intelligence. It could very well have been that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, once he began cooperating with authorities in March, had ratted this guy out.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, of course, the guy many people may remember in our audience, the picture of him pretty much in his pajamas being arrested in Pakistan several months ago, a very important arrest. Now, there have been a number of arrests, Eric, in the past less than 2 years, I guess, since 9/11.
Right.
Many of them right away, the attorney general is on the microphone. He's holding a press conference. This one, no word of this for 3 months. He was held in secret custody. Why do you think?
Well, what the FBI says is that this was such a sensitive case that they were still trying to chase down possible associates, possible people that this guy was in communication with, and that they didn't want to give up those possibilities by going public with the case. They're political cynics, mostly on the Democratic side, who suggest that Ashcroft has had a tough couple of weeks. There was a very damning report from his own inspector general a couple of weeks ago. He's taken some hits, and perhaps the timing, that might have played a part in the timing.
This guy, Ayman Faris, then, was still out and about just a couple of months ago, despite all the heat that's out there. How nervous should that make the average American that he's only been brought in the past 3 months or so, and he got very close, apparently, to possibly, well, doing an attack on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Right. Well, and I asked Ashcroft that very question. His response was, you know, we're glad we got him. Earlier is always better, but we got him early enough.
Yeah. Does 20 years seem like kind of a short sentence for an act of possible terrorism of that scale against the United States?
Well, it's interesting. They charged him with providing material support to terrorists, which is not the sort of the top rung charge. It's not, for instance, a conspiracy charge like what they brought against Zacharias Massawi. Some people question whether that indicates that perhaps he was not the high-level threat that they're making him out to be. You know, the flip side of that is that when you're dealing with plea negotiations, you know, usually the government is going to have to cut him a little bit of slack in order to get him to plead guilty.
Eric Lischblau, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Lischblau covers the Justice Department for the New York Times.
McDonald's is hoping some customers may soon be a little happier about the Happy Meal. In less than a year, McDonald's will require that its direct meat suppliers not use growth-enhancing antibiotics on animals. And the company is also asking for further reductions in other antibiotic use by suppliers. Well, joining us to talk about the significance of this decision is Gwen Ruta. She's program director for the Environmental Defense Organization, which worked with McDonald's to craft the new policy. Welcome, Gwen.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, Gwen, your group is now working with McDonald's, but along with others, you've been very critical of antibiotic use in the past. So tell us why.
We're working to reduce antibiotic usage both in animal agriculture and in human medicine, because basically what we're finding is that there's so much antibiotics out there in the environment, it's causing a phenomenon called antibiotic resistance, which means bacteria are getting smarter. They're learning how to resist antibiotics. And so when people get sick, they're less likely to be helped by antibiotics. And we want to preserve the effectiveness of these life-saving drugs.
And meat producers are using the antibiotics both to increase growth in animals and to, some would say, overprotect them from disease. What danger is that to humans when they eat the meat?
As long as the meat is properly prepared, there's no real danger of the transfer of bacteria, but in meat handling and in lots of other different ways, bacteria do get transferred from animals to humans, or can be transferred from animals to humans.
And this is antibiotic-resistant bacteria in some cases.
Exactly.
Right. Well, this policy of McDonald's won't ban all antibiotic use. Tell us what it does do.
It bans the use of antibiotics as what are called growth promoters, which are basically using antibiotics in low dosages over low periods of time to increase weight gain in animals. The drugs are not being used in any way to cure disease in animals or even to prevent or protect animals against disease. So they're being fed to healthy animals.
And they're also issuing guidelines. What are some of the guidelines as to other antibiotic use?
Yes, they've issued a set of what they're calling sustainable use principles for antibiotics. It's not rocket science. It's things like making sure that a veterinarian is overseeing all antibiotics use and never using antibiotics in place of good animal hygiene and keeping good records on the kinds of antibiotics and the amounts that you use. They seem like common sense practices, but they're not necessarily standard practice in animal agriculture in the U.S. and certainly not around the world.
And might restrictions like those go a long way in changing the way animals are treated?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons so many antibiotics are being used right now in animal agriculture is just because of the conditions in which animals are being kept. And what we're looking for is for producers to change those conditions, change their farm management in ways that will allow them to reduce the amount of antibiotics they need to use.
How much money would it involve to change it?
Well, McDonald's has been able to make this change without any increased cost to the consumer. So what we're able to show is that at least at the steps that we're looking at now, eliminating growth promoters will not increase costs.
And what about to the suppliers? What does it do along the chain?
You know, it's really unclear about how the cost structure is. Some suppliers have told us that it may increase their costs. Others have told us that actually it may not, because the antibiotics cost money too. So if you stop buying them, the cost may actually go down.
Mm. Well, Gwen, thank you.
My pleasure.
Gwen Ruta is Program Director for Environmental Defense. She spoke to us from her Boston office.
Money is tight now in many millions of U.S. households, but money's flowing fast and furious to the present resident of the White House. Earlier this week, President Bush kicked off his 2004 campaign for re-election with a shindig at the Washington Hilton, raising in that one night a tidy $3.5 million. And on a 10-city sweep in the next several days, the president is expected to raise a lot more and eventually somewhere in the vicinity of $200 million. Joining us on the line is Steve Weiss, Communications Director for the Center for Responsive Politics. Steve, welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
Steve, have we ever seen anything like this?
We haven't. Bush himself set the record by far in 2000 for the amount of money raised by a presidential candidate. And at that time, he raised just over $100 million. So with a goal of about $200 million, he is set to break his own record by two times.
Now, we've all heard about campaign finance reform. Can you remind us just briefly how much has changed since that campaign finance reform? How much can people contribute to make up this possibly eventually $200 million?
An individual can give a candidate $2,000 now, whereas in the 2000 election, the maximum was $1,000. In addition, unlimited contributions to the parties, which we commonly call soft money, are no longer allowed, meaning the limited contributions to candidates are set to increase, in addition to the fact, again, that they're already doubled. President Bush mastered the art of raising money in the maximum amount of $1,000 before, and he's certainly going to try to collect the maximum of $2,000 from as many people as he can this time around.
So does it suggest that more people are contributing, or it's just the same number of people roughly who are contributing but able to contribute more individually?
It's in large part because the same number of people are going to be contributing, and many of them are going to be contributing 2,000 rather than 1,000. But this shouldn't lead us to believe that Bush is collecting all of his money in the maximum amount. There are many, many people out there, and Republicans are particularly good at this, in collecting amounts of $50, $25. They raise huge sums of money, both in small amounts and in large amounts.
Now, Steve, are you concerned about all this? It's all legal. People feel passionately about President Bush, some people?
They certainly feel compassionate about President Bush, but there are obviously many of them out there who are wanting more than just a good democracy in response for their contributions. They have an interest in getting access to elected officials, in pursuing an agenda.
Well, isn't that natural enough? Don't the Democrats do the same thing?
Precisely. It really works the same with both parties. But the point is that it's the interests with money that get their agendas heard most of the time.
Who are the donors?
Executives and companies, political action committees affiliated with companies as well as with labor unions, millions and millions of individuals across the country who want to give money.
Are taxpayers helping fund the president's tours in any way as he goes around collecting money? How does that work?
The taxpayers might be paying for part of it. If the president goes on a trip and there is an official presidential purpose to it, his transportation to and from will be paid by the taxpayers. If during that trip he schedules a fundraiser, his campaign will have to pay for the car ride from the hotel over to wherever the event is. But in all likelihood, they won't have to pay for the airfare itself. So the president and presidents have done this for a long time. We'll try to combine campaign activities with official activities so the taxpayers pay for most of the costs of the trip as a whole.
Steve, what does this mean for Democrats?
They're in an extra difficult position because they haven't yet decided who's going to represent them in the general election. The Democrats that are running now are going to spend the majority of their money facing off against each other. Meanwhile, Bush, who has no opposition for the Republican nomination, can spend every last dime that he raises making himself look good and or criticizing Democrats.
Steve Weiss, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Steve Weiss is Communications Director for the Center for Responsive Politics.
Just ahead, Red Sox greats Dom DiMaggio and Johnny Pesci on their teammate and friend, Ted Williams.
And later, the truth changes again about Private Jessica Lynch, our editorial roundtable on what to believe.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
I recently was lucky enough to talk to Red Sox baseball legends Johnny Pesci and Dom DiMaggio about their 70-year friendship with baseball giant Ted Williams.
He has the right words.
Johnny Pesci, why don't you start? What was it about Ted Williams that made him sort of the center of your group?
Well, it looked like he had a light on top of his head. That's the way he affected me. And when he held court, he held court. And he had three of the best listeners to listen to him.
He commanded attention. When he walked into a room, he was tall and you had to look up to look at him. He just attracted attention.
Well, Dow, remember when we all got back after the war was over, he'd come into the clubhouse and in a loud voice, Captain Williams is here.
Here's the pitch. Williams swings, and there's a long drive to deep right. That ball is going, and it is gone. A home run for Ted Williams.
Did you all make each other better baseball players?
Yes. He led off. I hit second. Ted hit behind me. And our ultimate job, Robin, in baseball lingo, we had to get on base. We had a lot of fun playing it, too. We'd laugh at one another and say, well, you do this, you do that. But we went through the whole process like it was a stage play or something like that.
That's right. I mean, as a leadoff man, my job was to get on base. Because once I got on base, then I had Johnny behind me and have the guys behind us drive us in.
Talk about sacrifice. Fly.
Well, no, it was for the best interest of the team. That's what we're there for.
That's right.
Robin, but the great teacher says you got to get a ball, you get a strike, you got to hit it. And if you hit it, you better hit it hard.
That's Professor Williams, you're correct.
Yes, yeah, Ted. We sat in the corner of the clubhouse. I can still see it. Bobby here, Dominic, and I can still see Dominic with a towel over his shoulder having a cup of coffee. There's the Professor Williams, and I'm sitting alongside of him, and now he'd start, and he'd say, so-and-so is pitching. You got to expect this. You got to look for this. You got to look for that. And I said, oh, my God, you got to be a Rhodes Scholar to understand you.
Dom, Johnny, and Teddy, they were a fierce force, together scoring 100 runs in 6 years. And with another California native and future Hall of Famer, Bobby Doerr, they forged a legendary friendship. That friendship is at the heart of an elegant new book by author David Halberstam. It's called The Teammates.
It's not really my book. It's their book.
Johnny Pesky and Dom DiMaggio recently appeared at a book signing with Halberstam, a couple hundred adoring Red Sox fans, and Boston storyteller Dick Flavin.
I've been along for the ride for so long, and I was along for the ride down to Hernando, Florida, and I'm still along for the ride.
Dick Flavin was official first friend to the Fab Four teammates. He was also involved in the story that prompted Halberstam to write the book. The story of how, right after the events of 9/11, Dom and Johnny, both octogenarians, decided to drive the 1,300 miles from New England to Florida to see their very ill and dying friend, Ted, for the last time.
At the time, I wasn't overly enthused about flying. And then my wife rebelled, and she said, you can't drive at your age. She says, I don't think you should be driving. And Dick Flavin happened to be with us, and said, well, I'll come with you. Well, that opened up the doors. I said, that lit a light in my head. I said, oh, great, Dick. And I said, let's call Johnny Pesky.
Road trip.
Yep. And I said, here it comes. And John jumped at the opportunity. And then the whole thing gelled together.
And we were all anxious to get there. Dick and Dom did all the driving. I sat back in the back seat like Mussolini with my arm. And I'm listening to this jibber-jabber up in the front seat. One of them get on the other about driving the car, when they should pass, when they should stay in the lane, and all this.
I had seen Ted rather often, so I knew what to expect.
When we went in to see him for the first time, I thought I was going to cry, because here's this man that was all man and had a great charm about him. Even in his loud-voiced way, he had charm. And we actually loved this person, this man that we admired so much.
When we walked in the front door, you have to picture, you walk in the front door, and about 30 feet away in the living room, he is sitting in this wheelchair facing the front door. So I open the door, and I walk in first. John comes in behind me. And as I step aside, John sees Ted for the first time. Now, Ted doesn't see John because he can't see him that far away. And John is shaken. Yeah, and he sees this big rugged guy, worn down to a mere shadow of himself. And it affected him. So when he finally recovered, he started walking toward him. And I kept yelling to Ted, Johnny's here, Teddy, John's here, Johnny Pesky, where? And when he finally saw him, it's hard to describe the look that Teddy had when he saw John. And it was just a grateful look. He was so appreciative that John was there visiting with him.
Well, that would be the same, I think, if this happened to any one of us, that we had so much care for one another, Robin. I think it boils down to that.
Ted Williams died on July 5th, 2002. His 70-year friendship with Dom, Johnny, and Bobby Doerr is now read about and celebrated by new generations of baseball fans. But author David Halberstam is not sure it will be repeated.
Four guys growing up all on the West Coast, coming to one team, a baseball mad town, in roughly the same time, having this friendship, the love. That won't happen again. Big money, free agency, planes instead of trains. You'll never have that kind of affection and human texture again. And they were appreciative of the good things and the good things that endured in their lives in the way that many Americans now take good things that happen to them for granted.
You left one thing out, how we loved it. We loved it.
Oh, yeah, Dominic and Bobby and me and Teddy. You know, we were known as the Big Four from the West Coast. We were the Rabble Rousers, but we had a great love for the game of baseball and for each other.
Red Sox legends Johnny Pesky and Dom DiMaggio, and David Halberstam, author of the new book about their friendship with Ted Williams. It's called The Teammates.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, Iraqi military officials may have tried to kill Private Jessica Lynch. Our press panel looks at this shifting story.
We are more than eager. Yep. To jump onto a story, and not necessarily as eager maybe to sort through and poke holes in it.
And The Eye, a new horror film from Hong Kong about a blind woman who gets more than her sight after a cornea transplant.
You know, she saw dead people. I saw The Sixth Sense. I saw Eyes of Laura Mars. I saw several other films here, some better, some worse.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. An investigating officer is recommending the court-martial of a soldier charged in the deadly March grenade attack on soldiers in Kuwait. The investigator says Sergeant Hassan Akbar had ample time to acquire the grenades used in the attack against fellow soldiers from the 101st Airborne. Two officers were killed and 14 others wounded in the attack. Akbar chose not to testify in his own defense. He could face the death penalty if convicted in a court-martial. Secretary of State Colin Powell is in the Middle East for meetings with the Palestinian and Israeli prime ministers. Powell is calling Hamas an enemy of peace and says the Palestinian Authority must do more than simply negotiate a truce.
We would expect that anybody participating in public life in the state of Palestine would be individuals and organizations that are firmly committed to democracy, to the rule of law, not to terrorism. But right now, Hamas is committed to terror.
Meanwhile, another attack in the West Bank today killed one Israeli and wounded three others. American intelligence officials say they believe Saddam Hussein is still alive and still in Iraq. New efforts are reportedly underway to search for the deposed Iraqi leader. But Iraq's civil administrator Paul Bremer told NBC's Today show that Saddam's status is still unclear.
I think actually the intelligence community and the military is divided on the question of whether he's alive or dead. We frankly don't know. I wish we did know. I think it would be nice to have that particular chapter completely ended.
The search is reportedly being led by a secret military group that includes elite Army and Navy troops supported by the CIA. A raging wildfire has spread across a mountaintop north of Tucson, Arizona, and has already destroyed up to 250 homes. Firefighters are working to contain the flames, but have been struggling with high winds and low humidity. The cause of the fire is still unknown. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 77 points at 92.57. The NASDAQ composite is ahead 2 points at 16.51. And the S&P 500 is up 6 points at 1,001. It's 33 minutes past the hour, and you are listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Today, the New York Times has the latest journalistic take, the latest plot thickening, in the saga of Private Jessica Lynch. Columnist Nicholas Kristof reports that Lynch was to be executed by military officials holed up at the hospital where she was kept in Iraq after her capture. Plans were to blow up an ambulance with her in it, Kristof reports, and blame it on the Americans or to shoot her, though that failed when the executioner deserted. Now, it's hardly the first time Private Lynch's story has been changed. Earlier this week, The Washington Post re-examined the Saving Private Lynch story and found initial reports that she had been shot, maybe stabbed, and that had courageously fought back, fired back at against attacking Iraqis. They found all of it to be untrue. Which prompts us to ask this question. Can you really believe everything you read in the papers? That's what we're asking our editorial roundtable today. Joining us on the line are Nolan Finley. He's editorial page editor of the Detroit News in Michigan. Hi, Nolan.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. And Alicia Blaisdell-Bannon. She's managing editor of the Cape Cod Times in Hyannis, Mass. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, Bill.
Alicia, are you troubled by all these endless revelations about Private Lynch?
Yes, I'm troubled and I'm confused. Toward the, I think it's the third graph from the bottom, and Nick Kristof's column this morning in the New York Times, he asks this question: is this account the truth? I don't know.
Right. I mean, and the newspapers are supposed to be all about getting us an early version of the historical truth of what happened.
Yeah, I think somewhere along the line, I don't exactly know when this happened, whether this was 9/11 or whether this was happening before 9/11. But it feels to me like the truth has become kind of the, like dental flossing, you know? It's something you sort of work toward, but it's the ultimate goal. But
never really get around to.
Yeah, you can never really get there. And I can imagine that the reading and listening public is even more confused than we are.
But, Nolan, I hate to bring it up. It gets brought up maybe too much. It's one of those cliches, but it's a cliche that's right on the money. The fog of war.
Well, yes, and I would suspect, Bill, that if you take a historical perspective on this, if you take a historical look at this, you'll find that many of the stories of heroism that have come out of battle and wars during this country's history have been greatly embellished and turned out to be less than true. And I would suspect this is no different than that. I don't think that it's any sort of symptom of a new malaise. I think you've always had, when it comes to heroic stories, a bit of a fog.
Nicholas Kristof, who you alluded to earlier, the New York Times columnist today, calls the Lynch story a complex tale vastly oversimplified by officials. And he goes on to say, we weren't quite lied to, but facts were subordinated to politics.
Yeah, so what does that mean, we weren't quite lied
weren't
to?
Weren't quite lied to.
I mean, even if you set aside the Jessica Lynch part of it and this constant search for heroes and that jazz, now you have weapons of mass destruction. Where are they? What were we told? What sources were we relying on? What was the truth there? I mean, that's certainly a bigger issue than this one story of this one soldier or a lot of other things that we're worried about these days, whether we know the truth about.
But you know, Nolan said he doesn't think it's part of a new malaise. Hasn't there always been a spin coming out of places of power in the course of a war, in the course of any great event?
Yep, and I think it's our responsibility to try to see through that spin. Mm. I wonder how
sometimes the spin comes from us.
Yes,
you know, comes
exactly.
From the media itself. We are more than eager to jump onto a story.
Exactly.
Not necessarily as eager maybe to sort through and poke holes in it. It was a great story, and I think everybody wanted it to be true, and everybody wanted to be the first to tell it. And so, like many, many other stories of this nature, reporters grabbed up a few facts and ran. I don't think enough questions were asked.
Everybody wanted the weapons of mass destruction story to be true, too.
But, you know, guys, we're talking about how journalists have handled all this.
Right.
They're going to be TV specials. Won't that become the reality? TV specials about Private Jessica Lynch. Won't that become the reality most Americans and people around the world end up taking away from all this?
Well, I hope that young woman has the good sense to stay away from all that. And I would hope that she goes back to West Virginia and puts her life back together and lives the honorable life of a veteran, a combat veteran.
But
she served her country.
Absolutely. But, Alicia, how concerned are you that the ultimate reality take on all this will be what appears on network television or even the MTV special they're talking about?
Yeah, I have absolutely no hope that the scenario you present is going to happen, though I join you in wishing it were. And I do think that this will become yet another sort of half fiction, half truth, you know, and no one will ever know.
Alicia, let's shift our focus then just a bit in the time we have left. Tell us a story that's for real down on Cape Cod.
Our story that is for real and isn't for real, I guess, is the book that is being released on this rather sensational murder that we had a couple of years ago of Krista Worthington, who was a single mother and a fashion writer and was stabbed in her home, kind of remote home. And, of course, immediately we had to have somebody writing a book. Mm. The book is coming out in a couple of days, and a lot of people quoted in the book are now coming forward from a lot of different walks of life to say the quotes are fiction, some of them. And but will the reading public accept this as the truth? Well, probably.
Does the book come up with a suspect?
No.
Prime suspect?
No.
Yeah, yeah.
No.
Now, Nolan, a busy week, if that's the right way to say it, in Michigan. Real trouble there. Review it for us a bit.
Well, we've the big story in Detroit is that we have 17 police officers indicted on charges of running what can only be described as an organized crime ring within the department. They were shaking down dope dealers, beating citizens, extortion, threats, kidnapping, everything you can imagine these folks have been charged with. So Our police department's in a bloody mess here.
Meanwhile, up in Benton Harbor, riots.
Yes, we've had we had a few nights this week of race riots in Benton Harbor, which is a very interesting community in West Michigan. It's a primarily African-American community that sits across the river from a very prosperous white community. There's always been friction.
And anger against the police there, again, as in Detroit.
And anger against the police. But, you know, it flared up again this week when a motorcyclist who was fleeing from the Benton Harbor officers crashed into a building and was killed. And it just touched off. I don't know what they're going to do out there. This has been a problem that's been around 30, 40 years.
Well, let's finish in this discussion of what's real and what is not with what will really happen at midnight tonight. Harry Potter, that fantasy that's taken the entire universe by storm, it seems. Will you guys be online?
I'm past the Harry Potter stage personally, but a lot of bookstores here are going to be open and cash registers clinking, and that's plenty real for us.
Yeah, maybe we could use more wizards in this world. Thank you both. Nolan Finley.
Thank you, Bill.
Nolan Finley, editorial page editor of the Detroit News in Michigan, and Alicia Blaisdell Bannon, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Bill.
Managing editor of the Cape Cod Times in Hyannis, Massachusetts.
Still to come, a young woman sees more than she wants to after a cornea operation restores her sight in the new Hong Kong horror film, The Eye.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's estimated there are some 20,000 such life coaches worldwide. Many have trained and been certified. Some have taken a weekend workshop and hung out a shingle. Only a few have training in psychology, and that's caused concern in medical circles. Lynn Grodzki works in both worlds. She treats patients as a psychotherapist and clients as a life coach. And Lynn, tell us first off, what is the difference?
The differences between therapy and coaching can basically be understood in five ways, I think. The population, the purpose, the setting, the skill set, and the intention.
Okay, tell us about the population. How do you know that someone you're talking to as a life coach may need more than that, may really have some serious mental or emotional issues?
Well, coaches are really set up to work with that segment of the population that economists call the worried well. These are the higher functioning adults who would rate themselves as content, but they want more or feel blocked in some area of their lives. And these are the people who wouldn't normally seek psychotherapy, even when they have personal problems, because they don't identify themselves as feeling ill.
You understand that some people actually work with their life coach over the phone and never even meet them. But tell us, what are some of the things, just tick off, some of the things you might advise somebody on as a life coach?
Well, you might advise somebody on organization in their life. A lot of people feel absolutely overwhelmed. They can't prioritize tasks. They can't prioritize their time.
And we're not talking about how to put your pencils in a cup on the desk. It's there are broader issues, bigger issues, like what job to take.
Yes, so career is a big area because a lot of people are very bored or unhappy in their work life, and work is so important to us. And oftentimes they don't really have anybody to talk to about this who could really help them set direction.
Do you worry at all that the more unscrupulous in your professions might take advantage of the fact that, for instance, life coaches make more money than therapists do? So if somebody treats both, you know, I could see someone in a session saying, well, for double the fee, I could tell you what job to take as opposed to us talking for a while about how you feel about what job to take. You know, somebody taking advantage of life coaching.
Well, if you're a psychotherapist, it's really a very bad idea, and in most cases, it's against your licensure to have any kind of dual relationships. So you really need to decide if you're working with someone as a life coach or as a psychotherapist, and there's different kind of work that you do in each role. In terms of a person who's looking for a life coach, unfortunately at this time, even though there's about 20,000 people out there as life coaches, only 1% are certified by the professional association. So it's really buyer beware in the market, and you want to explore the background of your life coach, what their experience is, and check them out before you hire them.
And do I read that when you work with people as their life coach, you give them 7 minutes at the start of the session to whine?
No, I wouldn't say that.
How would you define it?
Well, what I do is we do a check-in process. So I want to hear what's happened from the last time, and specifically I want to hear what went well and what do you want to do in this session.
And do you cut them off at a certain point after they've detailed their problems and say, let's get on with it, which would be dramatically different from a therapy session, for instance?
Yes, because the hallmark of coaching is that I want to see concrete action each and every time we talk. So for that reason, it's really not geared to be just an open-ended session, a process. In fact, the processing part that happens in therapy, that's the part that's limited in life coaching.
Well, Lynn Grodzki, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Lynn Grodzki is author of the book, The New Private Practice, Therapist Coaches Share Stories, Strategies, and Advice.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The Pang brothers are identical twin filmmakers who were born in Hong Kong, live in Thailand, and are a hit all over Asia. Their latest film, The Eye, has now arrived in American theaters. It's inspired by a true event. A 16-year-old girl in Hong Kong received a cornea transplant and committed suicide a week later. The Pang brothers wondered, what could she have seen that affected her so deeply? Well, they took the sad tale and turned it into a ghost story about a young woman who regains her sight but ends up seeing more than she bargained for. Don't worry, it's subtitled. That's a scene from The Eye, the film we're talking about this week with our guest reviewer, Garo Ngosian. And Garo has organized a number of Hong Kong film festivals, including the ongoing Hong Kong Horror Series here in the Boston area. He also writes for Oriental Cinema and Asian Eye. So welcome back, Garo.
Thank you.
You saw this film first at the Toronto Film Festival. So right off, what did you think of The Eye?
I thought it was a good horror film, especially coming from Hong Kong, because in Hong Kong, they have a way of crowbarring large slapstick comedy sequences into their films. Mm-hmm. And in this film, it's pretty much a straight-ahead horror that seems to be more inspired by the success of The Ring in Hong Kong, the original Japanese version, which was a huge hit in Hong Kong. And I think it, you know, inspired them to go for more straight-ahead horror. And I think it works in this instance.
Well, Here and Now's film reviewers Renee Graham and Eric Schaefer have opinions as well on the film The Eye. They're also here in the studio. Renee, let's start with you. Tom Cruise already bought the rights to remake this picture in English, but the title tells much of the tale, doesn't it?
It does. The film concerns a young woman named Mun, played by Lee Sin Jae, who's gotten a corneal transplant to restore her sight. And once she gets the transplant, she begins to have visions, and she's trying to figure out what is it she's seeing, given that she hasn't had sight since she was two. But she's seeing ghostly figures, apparitions, and essentially she's seeing dead people.
Oh, boy.
姐姐,你有没有见过我张成绩表啊?成绩表?你还没玩回啊?
Again, the film is subtitled, but she starts seeing these ghosts. Are you saying then that it's sort of like The Sixth Sense?
You know, she saw dead people. I saw The Sixth Sense. I saw Eyes of Laura Mars. I saw several other films here, some better, some worse.
And it's a genre, Eric. But is this a horror film?
Yeah, it's a horror film, you know, sort of sliding into a ghost story. I suppose, you know, maybe calling it a ghost story might be a little bit more accurate. But it does have its horrific moments. I think the film has some pretty effective shocks early on when the young girl is first at the hospital and she's just undergone this cornea transplant and she's recovering and begins to see some of these apparitions. And I think the scenes in the hospital are particularly effective.
Okay. 现在你可以试一下, 慢慢打开你双眼。
And I met a man once who had a cochlear implant. He went from being deaf to hearing, and it was very difficult for him. So there is that element of someone suddenly having sight.
Well, and the filmmakers really actually handle that quite well, because there are certain sections, particularly in the first part of the movie, where they have left a plane within the frame out of focus. So you really do sort of experience what she's going through as she's regaining her sight and learning to use this new sense.
Well, Geralt, will it give away the plot to tell us why she's seeing these images?
Kinda.
Okay.
Yes.
We won't. But let's just refer back to the title, The Eye, and tell us more about what distinguishes an Asian horror film from a Western horror film.
Well, in the majority of Western horror films, it's always just like a bunch of redneck killers going around killing people. And in Hong Kong, it has to do more with the supernatural, the lore of different creatures like the hopping vampire. In American horror films, it's just like a bunch of scantily clad women and, you know, hunky guys going around having sex and then being mutilated into little bitty pieces.
Is that a bad thing?
You know what? There are good versions of those, but for the most part, 99% mm-hmm. of them are crap. Mm-hmm. I mean, just look at what came out in the last couple of months. Wrong Turn, House of a Thousand Corpses. I mean, they're dreadful, dreadful, dreadful movies.
Oh, boy, I feel the same way.
And
I don't know anything about this whole genre, but obviously you take this very seriously.
Yeah, and Hong Kong, it's a lot more imaginative. Like, if you watch a Hong Kong horror film, they really have a whole kitchen sink quality to them, because they'll try to give you every type of genre in the horror film, too. They'll try to give you a comedy, they'll try to give you a romance, and then they'll give you the horror, too. So it's a lot more fun. Of course, The Eye is less like that, because it's trying to be more mainstream, and its mainstreaming is actually getting a lot of attention from the Westerns by the remake. And in fact, they're already working on The Eye 2 in Hong Kong.
Well, one of the things that is sort of unique about this movie, certainly compared to American horror films, is that there's a good deal of sentimentality and sort of tenderness in this movie that comes through. Mun has a relationship with another patient, a young girl who has a brain tumor in the hospital, Ying Ying. And it's a very sweet, very gentle relationship they develop, and that's something that you're not used to seeing in most horror movies.
As scary films go, you know, rednecks running through the forest, hacking people to death isn't quite my cup of tea, but I think I found The Eye a little too subtle and a little too slow. I mean, it's a ghost story, and when I go see a ghost story, I expect to be scared or confused, but I found myself bored a lot of the time. They're just long stretches when there just wasn't a lot happening. You just wanted to get to the next point.
Well, obviously, in Asia, they have really embraced this film, and in fact, the film scene in Asia was reported to be faltering. That's why producer Peter Chan Ho's son founded Applause Pictures a couple of years ago to try to jumpstart the struggling industry. And this movie is huge there, right?
Yeah, it was really big. And Peter Chan, who also got picked by America to direct a movie here, he directed The Love Letter, that Tom Selleck, Ellen DeGeneres movie. Well, he went back to Hong Kong after that debacle and started like trying to find different directors from other Asian countries. And he produced another movie from Thailand called Jandara. And he also produced a movie called Three, which are three short horror films, one directed by himself, one directed by a Thai filmmaker, and one directed by a Korean filmmaker, which was also very popular. So he's actually trying to reestablish the Hong Kong film industry to be vibrant again like it was in the 80s and 90s.
You keep mentioning the Hong Kong scene, but these identical twin brother directors, the Pang brothers, they were born in Hong Kong, but they've been living for over a decade in Thailand. So is it a Thai film? Does it have Thai sensibilities?
Or? Well, I mean, you wouldn't call John Woo's Face Off a Hong Kong film. You'd call it an American film.
I had no idea.
Maybe the bigger question is, what's with all these brother acts these days? We've got the Pang brothers now, the Wachowski
brothers,
the Coen brothers. You know, this is an interesting trend. Maybe we need to bring a sociologist in or something to deal with that.
Well, Garrow, tell us, because you have this film series, before we let you go, We just want to know, what are some of the other films that are in your horror series?
Well, recently we showed Mr. Vampire Part 3, which is a just slapsticky horror gore kung fu film. We've shown Witch from Nepal, which is a Chow Yun-Fat movie where he has to fight a demon and zombies. And then this Wednesday at 8 o'clock, we have the big capper of the series, which is the classically named Devil Fetus, about a woman who gets near an evil vase. And the evil demon in the evil vase gets into her stomach, and the devil fetus pops up and runs amok, killing everybody. It's a fun, gory Hong Kong horror film.
Okay.
Excellent.
Well, since this is your thing, Garrow, what do you think of The Eye? Should people see it?
I thoroughly enjoyed The Eye. It's a good film, but as Renee said, it's derivative. And I think its derivativeness stops it from being a great film. But I actually think it's really worth seeing. And definitely, if you're into horror films, it's really the only horror film to see out there right now because all the American ones suck.
Okay.
So definitely see The Eye.
All right, then. Now, Renee, you also had a strong opinion as well. You snoozed through it.
Disappointed. It has its moments, but you shouldn't go in there expecting a scare a minute. It's not that kind of film.
Okay. And Eric?
I guess I'm kind of in the middle here. I would agree that it does kind of lag toward the middle part of the film, but it is different, and it's worth seeing.
Okay. Well, that's a mixed review, something for everyone. Our Here and Now film panel has been talking about The Eye, Asia's latest horror hit. Our guest reviewer this week was Garrow Ngozian, Hong Kong film buff and writer for Oriental Cinema and Asian Eye. For more on his film series, go to our website, here-now.org. Eric Schaefer is a film historian who teaches at Emerson College, and Renee Graham is pop culture correspondent for the Boston Globe.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
Have a great weekend, and when it's over, join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at MathWorks.com. Information on the web at MathWorks.com.